This is Paul. It's Thursday. I released this video with this thumbnail about the screens as and Profilicity as this horcrux that we attempt to construct a true self. And we attempt to multiply that true self ubiquitously, infinitely. The funny thing about the whole Horcrux narrative that sort of winds up the great Harry Potter story is that there are a limited number of Horcrux that they have to destroy with something hard enough. Remember, it was like this. Yeah, I don't remember the details. You Harry Potter, you people that were born when my children were born will remember the details. I don't. But the Horcrux had to be destroyed. For my generation, the ring had to go into the fires of Mount Doom, and Sauron would go. But in a sense, part of our death avoidance system is more related to Achilles, because we will be remembered not necessarily for having done something great like defeat Hector and get revenge on Troy, but for plastering ourselves all over the internet so that we can't be wiped. And so we're trying to place ourselves up into the screens, and the Horcrux in the screens is the only thing that matters. Except, of course, because there is no solution, as Jacob said, not Jacob Howland, not our Jacob.
Oh, actually, even let me go back. I said top-down solutions. The word solution, I almost want to excise it from the political vocabulary, because politics is a living, ongoing thing. It's a constant renegotiation. It's a constant.
Now, we are also living ongoing things. What we are dealing with, especially in this age of profilicity, is a constant renegotiation. But the question is, does all of this constant renegotiation ever go anywhere?
Constant putting new and fresh energy in to the system, like you got to paint your house, you know, you got to take care of things.
Yeah, it's a living organism, really.
Right.
It has
right.
a kind of opponent processing
Right.
aspect to it, where it's like right. you push a little harder this way, like
right.
order and chaos.
So who talks about solutions? Well, it's a technical notion, yeah, right? Yeah. It's almost like a mathematical thing. And I kind of repeat this phrase. It seems to me that all political solutions, like real solutions, are final solutions, right? That is to say, it's death in some way. Incidentally, Jonathan, I've been thinking about the 34th canto of the Inferno, where, which actually begins with the line, it's quoted in Latin, you know, the banners of the king of hell advance, right? So it kind of identifies Satan as the king. And we have this image of Satan, and remember that he's like stuck in the ice. It's all frozen. It's all, you know, none of the condemned can speak to Dante. They're frozen in these things, right? And then you have Satan, and one of the translators has calculated that he's sticking up 1,000 feet from the ice, like Tower of Babel or something like this, right? And in his mouth are, you know, Judas and Cassius and Brutus, and as this same translator John Sinclair mentions, these are the guys who served Satan best, you know. They're the guys who serve. But the revolution eats its own in a way, right? I mean, this rebellious angel falls down and crashes into the earth. I don't know. It's just it's a very rich image.
It's rich in relation to what we're saying, which is yeah. that, you know, the image of Aaron making the golden calf.
Yes.
You know, there is a relationship between that and the basic Promethean image of revolution. you know, and right. you see that, you know, the idea of taking that, we think that we're used to actually think of the Promethean story as something positive.
Now, the funny thing about revolution is, of course, it has two words. It has two meanings. It's revolution. It goes round and round. It never goes anywhere. I think it was Chad quoted Jonathan as saying the spiral is the most satisfying thing because it's both line and circle and it has progress. But the question, of course, is progress. It wasn't too long ago that I read and talked about this book, Ross Douthat's book on the decadent society. And his premise, of course, is that in some ways things have stopped. This is also sort of an Eric Weinstein premise. And this is a deep crisis for our civilization. On CRC Voices, I shared some of the thoughts that I put in the Thursday midday video on Mueller's profelicity thesis. And my friend Bill Harris on CRC Voices pointed me to this. Bill's a very regular reader of Proofrock. He is now has a Substack, and all the bloggers have gone to Substack. The title of it is Make It New, No More. Make It New, No More. In an essay in the latest issue of the New York Times Magazine, Jason Farrago makes two claims. One, culture is not progressing like it used to progress, and two, that it's not a bad thing. For 160 years, we spoke about culture as something active, something with velocity, something in continuous forward motion. What happened to a culture when it loses that velocity or even slows to a halt? Walking through the other galleries of the Met after a third visit to Manet Degas, I started doing that thing that all salon visitors used to do in Paris in 1866, ignoring the paintings and scoping out all the other spectators' clothes. I saw visitors in the skinny jeans that defined the 2000s and in the roomy high-waisted jeans that were popular in the 1990s. Neither style looked particularly au courant or dated. Manet was a fashion maven, and I've been marveling anew at the gauzy white-striped gown with flared sleeves that Bertha Morisot wears in the balcony to signal that she is a contemporary woman, that she is alive right now. What piece of clothing or accessory could you give a model to mark her as a young lady of 2023? A titanium-cased iPhone is about all that comes to mind, and even that hasn't changed its appearance in much of a decade. That's true. I was noticing in a film the other day, I was trying to sort of locate the film by the fashion, and often you can do that. And today you can sort of locate the film by the cinematography more than the fashion. You can locate it by the editing. Every now and then I'll watch a film of 50, 60 years ago or 80 years ago. And again, the pace of the film, the editing of the film, films from the 60s, films from the 70s, they have different looks, films from the 80s. And what's interesting is that, of course, there was this thesis, seemingly misunderstood thesis about the end of history. And perhaps we have arrived, but not in the way that we thought we would. To continue, to audiences in the 20th century, novelty seemed to be a cultural birthright. Susan Sontag could write in 1965 with breezy confidence that new styles of art, cinema, music, and dance succeed one another so rapidly as it seems to give their audiences no breathing space to prepare. Now, you could really write that in 1965 because, you know, not too long ago when I was taking a look at the Jesus Revolution, at the Jesus people, what swift change passed through this culture. If you look at 1963 and you look at 1968, even 5 years later, so much had changed. The Rest Is History did a really interesting episode on, let's see if I can find it. 60s fashion, the teenage revolution, and 60s fashion, the swinging London, episodes 1 and 2. What was fascinating about them was just how fast things moved and why London, why at that time. It hadn't been, you know, it had been Paris before that, but how things had changed. And the point here is how things are not changing. Today, culture remains capable of endless production. but it's far less capable of change. Intellectual property has swallowed the cinema. The Hollywood studios that once proposed a slate of big, medium, and small pictures have hedged their bets. And even independent directors have stuck with narrative and visual techniques born in the 1960s. Have you tried to furnish an apartment lately? Whether you are at Restoration Hardware or on Alibaba, what you are probably buying are replicas of European antiques, contemporary designs first seen in Milan in the 1970s or Weimar in the 1920s. Harry Styles is rocking in the 80s. Silk Sonic is jamming in the 70s. Somehow Frasier has been revised and they barely had to update the wardrobe. I think about this often when you listen to, say, music of the 20s and 30s. Then you get music of the big band sound of the during the Second World War. Then you have Elvis and rock and roll in the 50s. I know I'm covering Burn Powers area here today and with nowhere near the amount of knowledge that he has. And then, of course, I mean, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, just whoosh, 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 whoosh. And, of course, rap sort of remade things, and now you've got auto-tune that is sort of everywhere, but you very much have a sense of sort of decadence. There's when I listen to music today, it just all sounds retread. I don't particularly care for the breezy generalities that are now apparently part of the style, the house style, of the New York Times culture page. For 160 years, we spoke about culture as something active, something with velocity, something in continuous forward motion. Who is we, and what does active and velocity even mean with respect to culture as a whole? Sentences like these great, and Farrago's piece has a number of them. But I think he's generally right, that today's culture, that is, today's film, music, fiction, poetry, lacks a certain liveliness. There are exceptions, of course, and a lot of great work, but there's also a lot of work that feels recycled. The turn to politics in art that is a result of the lack of interest in aesthetic problems and confusion about beauty itself hasn't helped. Using art to make political statements became a way of disguising the lack of interest or confusion at the same time making otherwise mediocre works of art seem important. And again, this is politics as the new religion, but it's a really bad religion. It's a really religion that they say in Spanish, no sirve. It doesn't work. It doesn't serve. It doesn't serve its ends. Using art to make political statements became a way of disguising this lack of interest or confusion, and at the same time making otherwise mediocre works of art seem important. But in the end, the mediocrity is all too apparent. I think about that little thing that I showed this morning that Rod Dreher had found. I didn't actually play the video.
Glory to the martyrs!
Glory to the resistance!
Glory to the martyrs!
Glory to the resistance!
Do you know what he's saying when we say, we will liberate the land! There you go. We will liberate the land by any means necessary.
Even activism, you have to sort of break out into a riot and burn things to catch the news. That is not a recommendation. Please don't. But I remember growing up watching, of course, New York City news. I grew up just outside of New York City. And, you know, this kid over to the right is doing what all the kids in New York did whenever the television camera would show up on the streets is photobomb the journalist. All right, you're out in front of the library and you're just saying dramatically more and more over the top things to arrest our sensibilities because we've seen it all before. You're going to make it about politics and that's supposed to save it. I don't think so. Back to Farrago blames technology for this liveliness. The key factor that can only be what happened to us at the start of the century, first the plunge through our screens into an infinity of information, soon after our submission to algorithmic recommendation engines and the surveillance that powers them, the digital roots we embraced were heralded as catalysts for cultural progress. When they produced such chronological confusion that progress itself made no sense. It's Still One Earth, the novelist Stacy D'Erasmo wrote in 2014, but it is now subtended by a layer of highly elastic non-time, wild time, that is akin to a global collective unconscious where past, present, and future occupy one unmediated plane. This dark wood today and yesterday become hard to distinguish. The years are the only timestamps. Objects lose their dimensions. Everything is recorded. Nothing is remembered. Culture is a thing to nibble at, to graze on. Outside of time, this is why I think part of the reason there's such this emphasis on making again, make story, make poetry. The hope is that if you make something, maybe, but maybe, it will have significance and not fall into the pit that the book of Ecclesiastes laments, there's nothing new under the sun. Outside of time, there can be no progress. Only the perpetual trying on of styles and forms. Here years become vibes, or eras, as Taylor Swift likes to call them. And if culture is just a series of trends, then it is pointless to worry about their contemporaneity. There we go. There was a charming freakout last year when Kate Bush's 1985 single, Running Up That Hill, went to the top of the charts after its deployment on yet another nostalgic television show, and veterans of the big hair decade were horrified to see it appear on some 2022 playlist along with Dua Lipa and the like. If you think the song belongs in 1985 in the way Young Lady of 1866 belongs in 1866, the joke is now officially on you. End of quote from that New York Magazine piece. He's right that technology has flattened time. It has also flattened regional differences, which were always the source. Now, that's such an interesting, it's such an interesting observation in the crisis of authenticity. Because, as again, back to Mueller's thesis, once you record that thing from the region, once you record it, once you embody it in art, once you turn it into kitsch or trope, now it is no longer authentic. The authentic thing, now we're back into the realm of culture tourism. You have to go to Appalachia to see the real culture. You have to go to the place. You have to find the immigrants. You know, Chinese food is always this funny thing because there is, in fact, a culture of Chinese food all around the world. But when I talk to people, Chinese people, they'll say, well, we don't really eat that way. That's sort of the inauthentic Chinese food culture that is what you expect when you go to a Chinese restaurant. Here in Sacramento, if you want to go to eat Vietnamese food, you go to Lee at Little Vietnam. And all of these cultures, as with many immigrant cultures, are sort of frozen in time. You can find Dutch import stores that will import things, not that are being, let's necessarily, consumed in the Netherlands today, but were consumed in the memories of people. So you have this heavy dose of nostalgia, but via our affluence and our screens and our capacity to produce, we can live in the past by virtue of, or we can live in a facsimile of the past. What Farrago doesn't mention as a source of art's decline is a decline in religious belief. But surely it is also a contributing factor. Religion provides art with ideas worthy, also embodied in beautiful forms. As you might have picked up in my rough draft for Sunday last week, the church has to be strange enough to be seen as holy enough to feel authentic in a skeptical world. Richard Rowland makes a comment about, I should look for the direct quote because the direct quote was really quite good. But basically, for a church to be believable enough, it has to be immersed in something that doesn't feel, I would say, feel like a Chinese knockoff. He didn't say anything exactly like that at all. But that was my sense of it. That part of his attraction to orthodoxy was, it was a sense that it was better than going to a movie theater dressed up like Star Wars. It was better than LARPing. And of course, Luke had that very interesting conversation, the live stream in the morning on is orthodoxy LARPing? And generated some discussion, but the strange enough to be holy to feel authentic in a skeptical world. I think part of the reason religion is getting extreme is to avoid the consumer trap when everything feels like it's from the shelves at Target, including your religion. Great works of modern art that Ferrago praises as being so surprisingly new were themselves still indebted to religious understanding of art or to a memory of that understanding. Without religion, art is little more than a stimulus for excitement that has to compete with other stimuli. And I think this gets at the heart of it, that the whole quest for authenticity is a desire to be attached to the living root instead of the dead wood that is above. We have the sense that, and again, in the Peugeot-Howland conversation, they really got at this.
That a lot of the issues that we're confronting today were already identified by both of those traditions. And maybe one way to put it is, if we go back to the Platonic texts, Plato makes a distinction between acquisition and production as sort of kinds of sciences or arts. And philosophy is categorized under acquisition. What does that mean? The acquisition of knowledge, which is a kind of openness or receptivity to the world, right? So there's a kind of anthropology behind this. Human beings are these souls that relate fundamentally to reality. And our job, if you will, is to register those realities and to take them in. Now, production is, I mean, the Greek word is poiesis, which is, could also be translated poetry, but it just means production.
Making.
Yeah. And the thing is that there's no pure receptivity, I guess I would say. If you're doing philosophy, for example, and this is really the ancient sort of epistemology, you register, right, what is there, and then you articulate it. There's no philosophy without articulation. But that always has a productive dimension. You're using the tools that you have generated, for example, language. You're selecting which of those tools you're going to employ. I mean, you could represent reality mathematically or poetically or whatever. And so there's always this kind of productive element you're adding to what it is that you've taken.
And I think even the language, it isn't sort of producing in terms of making work. It's actually bringing up from below or bringing down from above that which is real and true, and that reality and that truth are what come in and actually add instead of simply recycle. Notice the terminology he used in terms of recycle, not Howland, but Maddox.
Taken in. Technology, from the Greek perspective, and I think this applies to the Bible as well, is obviously productive because we're making stuff. We're transforming nature, we're building. And the danger there is that it can interpose itself between us and reality. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately, if we sort of follow the line of technological development far enough, and here I would sort of flag AI, we might create a kind of virtual reality, that is to say, a humanly produced reality that substitutes for the world to which this philosophical and I would say biblical anthropology suggests that we are fundamentally meant to be open and to order ourselves by.
And again, he's drawn, we are not escaping a two worlds mythology. We have the real world and we have the unreal world, and we live in the unreal world, and the real world is the source for everything living and any sort of progress. The whole idea of progress as a value judgment is that we are moving towards a more real world. And that is at the heart of any religious any religious context, any religious movement, any religious process, any religious enterprise. That is the definition of eschatology, that you're moving towards a realer world. And again, the sense is that we're kind of, as a culture, we're kind of stuck. We're not making much progress.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I read even in college, also because of postmodernists really, is the Plato's Phaedra, where Socrates talks about writing itself as having that problem, which is something that a lot of modern people would be surprised, because we're actually like beyond writing. It's like whatever effects writing had on civilization, we're way beyond it. But in some ways, it was exactly that problem, which is that we as humans are living spirits, right? We are breathing living spirits that manifest meaning, that take in meaning, but there's a kind of organic dance to that, right? Whereas as soon as you fix something, then it, on the one hand, it makes it more powerful because, right, you can send your texts out, you can send emails out. But on the other hand, it can in fact interpose itself the way you said. It's a supplement. It's an adding to language, and then it can become a kind of opacity to what it is that you're saying. You know, if we're talking, you know, you and I face to face, and you don't understand what I'm saying, you know, you can ask me and I can answer, and then we can have this kind of back and forth where we're tuning in and we're tuning closer to what we want. But if you read a text, that's it. Like, that's what you have. And so on the one hand, it makes it possible for me to access the thoughts of people that I can't meet, but it also at the same time creates that difficulty, which is that, you know, it's like these fixed words are my vision of what it is that's coming down to me. You know, it's a means that
ChatGPT is cannibalizing itself in a way. So just to be clear, right? What does ChatGPT do? Well, it goes out there and it kind of looks at all this data, right? Goes to the internet, right? Which is not a particularly intelligent pool on the average. I mean, you just, which is incidentally why ChatGPT makes stuff up, because it obviously sort of can't sort out what's true or what's false. And so it kind of looks at things and makes these what it thinks are logical connections, but yeah. So that if a student
just calculates semantic distance,
is right. I mean, there was a professor told me about a paper he'd gotten on Romeo and Juliet, you know, and it was like Romeo, you know, the Capulets and the Montagues and so forth. And then Juliet catches a cab and she goes to, you know, and so, I mean, because this is right. So you kind of take this low pool and you scoop it all up and you connect these things and you spit something out, and then that becomes part of the larger pool, which the next ChatGPT iteration, you know, looks at. So it's sort of like consuming your own waste. Now, what's interesting.
They cut ChatGPT off from, they stopped training it a few years ago.
Oh.
Now they've actually cut it. It's only within itself, but they can't do that forever. Like, I know they probably did it because they know the problem that they're setting up in the world. But at some point, they're going to have to reopen it because they can't. If they want ChatGPT to keep up with what's happening, they'll have to reopen it so that it goes back and starts to recalculate. So I think they're looking for a solution for it, but at least for now they have cut it off, which is something Bing hadn't done for a while, and that's why Bing was like a psycho. Like, Bing would just go into psycho mode and just become like your stalking ex-girlfriend, or, you know, turn into, you know, like the like passive aggressive or whatever. Like, they were all, it had all these personality defaults because it was literally training.
So you can see, once it's sort of cut off from that living source, it deteriorates. Again, I think about Inception and in the movie where the virtual world starts turning against the host that is, it is dependent upon. Thomas Flight has a great video on his channel. It's from about a year ago. Why Everything Everywhere All at Once Hits So Hard. And, well, let's just get into it.
Feeling I've started encountering in recent years. It's hard to describe. It's kind of uncomfortable, fractal, overwhelming, disorienting, but at the same time, enticing and kind of awe-inspiring. For a while, I didn't know where this feeling was coming from, what was causing it, or how many other people might be feeling what I was feeling. But then in 2021, I started noticing a few artists depicting the feeling that I was having. Bo Burnham was the first to put his finger on it with his comedy special, Inside.
There it is again, that funny feeling, that funny feeling.
But another recent work which captures the feeling in an even more fundamental way is the hypermodern, maximalist, everything, everywhere, all at once.
Now, it makes perfect sense that the pandemic would really intensify this, because sort of like ChatGPT being cut off from the internet for a while because they understand that it's going to be consuming its own waste and it's going to simply get dumber and dumber and more psycho. Well, suddenly we who are the next level source for the internet, now we're consuming our own waste on the internet. And we're going to have to process this. And of course, processing this, one of the ways we process it is through our poets, which means through our films.
You underestimate how the smallest decisions can compound to significant differences over a lifetime. Every tiny decision creates another branching universe. Another. Were you not paying attention before?
It's easy to get bogged down in the technical elements of multiverses and how they work either as a storytelling device or as an actual theory for our own cosmos. But what I'm most interested in about the multiverse as it's used in Everything Everywhere All at Once is as a metaphor for our own world and our own personal experience, especially as a metaphor for the experience of
the internet.
I love the internet. I've always loved...
Now, modernity has a deep assumption about heaps. Now, when you read in the New Testament, when Jesus talks about don't heap up for yourself heaps on earth, that's sort of what the New Testament says. They have treasures on earth, and the New Testament translators sort of make it more elegant, but don't heap heaps. And the internet and this ability to remanufacture our horcruxes infinite number of times on the internet through social media to capture more attention, to gain more eyeballs, to all of this is sort of a belief in heaps that more is better. And so ChatGPT consuming its waste, getting dumber and dumber, well, this is kind of what we're doing as a culture with the internet. Again, from Friday Morning Nameless, I'm going to have to clip this thing. Now, if you didn't watch what this is, during the Seeker movement, sermons were introduced by sketches. Willow Creek sort of popularized this. I don't know if they came up with this, but they popularized it in the 80s. And so then the Sikh part of the Seeker movement liturgy were all of these sketches. And of course, as mega churches grew larger and larger, the sketches have taken on more and more production value, as we call them. And so what Chad actually finds here is a mega church. This is the introduction to their Sunday sermon, which is probably just as long, if not longer, than the Sunday sermon. And then here's a musicalized Jonathan Peugeot treatment that Chad puts on top.
The internet has afforded a space where the relationship between attention and power has been increased, you know, by thousands of times. And so all of a sudden, people understanding that how attention can be a weapon, right? And attention can be a way to dominate and can be a way to seduce. And now you have 100,000 people, you know.
Part of what's amazing is that in all likelihood, this megachurch is, you know, would be horrified at a rainbow festooned, totally woke mainline church with hardly anybody in it. And then this is church two.
100,000
100,000 people under you that can act as your body, that how attention can be a weapon, right? And attention can be a way to dominate and can be a way to seduce. Now you have 100,000 people, you know, 100,000 people under you that can act as your body.
What you're talking about.
Yeah, and the internet is like a monster. The internet is like a being that lives through attention. The internet is like a monster. The internet requires our attention, to exist. Like,
and I think this mega church has a set department and a costume department. And okay, so is this progress on the megachurch front?
Loved learning about new and novel world and our own. Love the internet. I've always loved learning about new and novel things and have had an insatiable curiosity. And for someone who could spend all their time exploring what's out there if they didn't have to do other things like eat, pay rent, and socialize, the internet has been an endless garden of delight and possibility. The internet has an inexhaustible variety of cool stuff and tons of fascinating people and ideas to discover. The internet is why I get to do something like this as a job, but it's a double-edged sword.
I thought I was disconnected. Why was I still there?
Your mind is like a clay pot holding water. Every jump opens another crack, causing things to leak through.
Even when pointed at seemingly productive learning and not just mindless entertainment, when given the option to fulfill endless curiosity, there comes a tipping point, a crossing of the bell curve.
Sucked into a bagel.
Here's the thing. We don't need an actual multiverse to put cracks in the clay pot of our mind when we already have devices for careening through the endless imaginations of the multitudes. When we exist in an environment where you can encounter the personal stories and experiences from people on every continent, all who are living their own unique life in just a few minutes, all from the comfort of your own toilet. When more interesting ideas, concepts, people, and places can fly by in the space of one 30-minute TikTok binge than some of our ancestors experienced in the entirety of their localized illiterate lives. The internet, for those who are inspired to spend a lot of time on it and use it in a certain way, for those who envelop themselves in its self-referential world of constantly evolving novelty and imagery, will inevitably have a profound effect on the way you see the world. What?
Now, at what point do we start doing what ChatGPT does? I mean, we all have all these memes of non-player characters. And to what degree does the internet make us into one? Now, it's really interesting because in terms of the view of authenticity, locality, particularity, the continual mix of culture, but the percentage of culture and humanity sort of put together. I think about this one church visit I did in the Dominican Republic. So what I would often do on Sundays is I would travel to a particular church, and usually they had me, they wanted me at a particular church for a baptism or a special event or something. So I was the missionary that these little churches in far-flung communities would trot out, and by showing me to the people, I would give the people standing. I remember having this argument with one pastor because, of course, I'm there fresh out of seminary, and I've got all my egalitarian views. And I'm trying to tell them that I am no more important than any of the pastors. In fact, the local pastors are far more important than I am. I'm there maybe to teach them a little bit of philosophy, to help them out in a way or two. But for the most part, I am unimportant. And the pastor, who was at that point twice my age, looked at me and said, basically, you're full of crap. You are important. Without you, I mean nothing. And I just thought, what am I doing here? You, who come from North America, give me status and credibility in this community because there are a dozen other little churches like that, but I can bring you in here. And that shows that I have power and I have connection. And maybe, just maybe, you will be the connection to a scholarship for my son, a visa para sueño. That was a popular song of the Dominican Republic when I was there. the visa for the dream, that I was the connection to the divine, or at least the United States, Nueva York. And I was horrified by this fight, but it was very clear I was not going to talk him out of it. And it was very clear that all the other pastors I worked with believed the same way he does, and that's why they brought me there. So anyway, I spent many of my Sundays going from church to church, being that connection to Visa para Sueño. And we went to one church near the Haitian border. And I've told this story before. And we get out there, and the place is rough. I mean, we're sitting on these, they had hurriedly adapted some kind of structure for this worship service. We had a big baptism in this stream, flows quite near the Haitian border. I preached a sermon, various pastors preached sermons, the people were baptized. I've got pictures of it. And I remember during the worship service, they didn't have much in terms of musical instruments. And again, for many Haitian worship services, musical instruments could be a can to bang on or something to put beads in so you could shake. And so in this particular church, some of the people took to basically doing something like you'd hear in some beat poetry, where there'd be sort of beatbox, bing, 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 boom, boom, boom. This is what was going on. This was the musical accompaniment for the songs. And of course, everybody knew all the songs because the songs were the songs that we sang in almost all of the services, especially when the missionary would come. And I was hearing this and I was just kind of looking side-eyed at it, wondering, what is this? And then I'm looking at the other pastors and they're looking too. And then we got into the car afterwards and we're sort of debriefing, and the pastors are like, I've never seen anything like that. There you have it. Authenticity, grown out of a tiny little community where the ratio of human to culture just gets sprinkled. But now with the internet, culture is this fire hose that absolutely deluges it and sort of washes the reality away.
In its self-referential world of constantly evolving novelty and imagery, will inevitably have a profound effect on the way you see the world. What is the result of this headlong dive through novel ideas and imagery? Many astronauts, upon seeing the Earth for the first time from space, spinning by below them, report something that has been dubbed the overview effect. When they see the world they've always known from such a radical,
sort of like the monarchical vision,
radically different viewpoint, flying by in its entirety in the space of 90 minutes, hundreds or thousands of times, it can cause a significant paradigm shift in how they view life and the world. I don't think the effect of being very online is the same thing as the overview effect that astronauts experience. But I think there's a lighter weight analogous effect that can happen from consuming the amount of information that many of us now do using the internet. Seeing so much of the world so quickly can trigger a sort of psychological paradigm shift. The shift isn't coming from being exposed to a single new idea or perspective that forces you to reassess your own. The shift comes from the sheer amount of perspectives and ideas that we can now be exposed to online. The shift.
Pluralism was sort of the bugbear of the modern era in religion. The amount of information, and then of course the internet suddenly puts that, magnifies that incredibly. So now suddenly we see this turn into religions that require initiation. In sort of peak modern frontier Christianity, all you needed to do to get baptized was stand up in Sunday morning and say, Pastor, baptize me. Now, of course, initiation means, well, you're going to be a catechumen for a year. You've got to be chrismated and yada, 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 yada. We want to get you in. And if you're going to do the Exodus 90 thing, you're going to be out in terms of screens. And so the pushing away of the screens is obviously a key part of the process of catechizing the initiate.
From being online all the time contains some positives, but it can also leave you stuck in a state of overwhelm, constantly considering alternative life paths, constantly comparing your own experience to the experience of others, unable to hold a consistent view of what's real or what is important.
Now, this, of course, brings us right back to this culture. Now, the next article that he puts in here, he sort of does what a lot of bloggers do, sort of three ideas in this post. In other news, half of our waking hours are now devoted to entertainment. Now, again, that whole word. Let's have Grim Grizz have at that word. That word. Half of our waking hours are now devoted to set. And the children of Set that we carry around in our pockets. Are you not entertained? If not, you have just yourself to blame. Your neighbors now spend most of their waking hours getting entertained, according to research outfit Luminate. What a name. This number has grown 22% in the last year. How is this even possible? Don't people have jobs? Don't they have family obligations? Don't they have a life? Maybe not. But who cares, so long as the TikTok videos keep reeling? Patrick Kerp explains why Samuel Taylor Coleridge was a brilliant windbag junkie. U2's The Edge talks about the band's opening night at the Sphere, Las Vegas's otherworldly 2.3 immersive concert hall. We started hearing a visceral reaction to some of the visual ideas. It was so funny. Our mix engineer was backstage doing the live audio for the TV feed that night. He was used to hearing crowds responding to big choruses and guitar solos and whatever, but he was completely confused by these huge roars that seemed to be happening in the middle of the song. They were responding to the visuals. And on and on and on it goes.
People, I think the digital overview effect is a gradual and pervasive accumulation, slowly building up as we swim through a world of thoughts, ideas, concepts, and emotions, all projected at us through images, text, and video, one after another in an endless parade. Each new idea can pull you in a different direction, and there's a certain point, if you go far enough and fast enough, where everything, the infinite possibility of life, starts to blur by and look and feel like nothing. And at that point, the entire thing collapses on itself.
What is the truth?
Nothing matters.
Where have we heard that before? It all means nothing in the end. It's the fire hose of culture, but there is no culture in the culture. It is so diluted, or at least it is passing over us so quickly. None of the nutrients, none of the reality can actually embed and implant and find its way to our mouths.
For me, Everything Everywhere All at Once is one of the first true post-internet films. It's not just about the internet. It doesn't just comment on the internet, but fully embraces it in all of its absurdist, chaotic glory. The maximalist excess and complete tonal whiplash from one moment to the next captures the unhinged, unfiltered anarchy of using the internet in a way that nothing else I've ever consumed has.
She appears to be in a universe where everyone has hot dogs instead of fingers.
This is a movie for people who have found themselves blinking sleep out of their eyes with 50 tabs open at 2 a.m., which I suspect is many more of us than we'd openly care to admit.
And this, of course, sets up Thomas Flight's newer film on metamodernism.
And now it's time for what I know you've all been waiting for.
By the time we get to 2022 with a movie like Everything Everywhere All at Once, many of the elements of postmodernism still remain. The movie is a never-ending pastiche of pop culture and film references, much in the same way the postmodern Pulp Fiction was. Everything Everywhere constantly plays on genre tropes and has a silliness that rivals a film like Monty Python and the Holy Grail, all while leaning heavily into a nihilist postmodern deconstruction of modernist philosophy like we see in something like No Country for Old Men.
Right is a tiny box invented by people who are afraid.
But unlike the postmodern films, Everything Everywhere All at Once also contains a sincere depiction of sentiment that most postmodern movies never have. It also harnesses a sort of optimism and emotional sincerity that rivals that of modernist films like High Noon or Top Gun Maverick.
Metamodernism in general can be thought of as a response to postmodernism. It builds on postmodernism.
Right.
It's not just in opposition to postmodernism. In Everything Everywhere All at Once, nihilism is a big theme. But if it were merely a postmodern film, it would stop there. But instead, in one of the culminating scenes, Evelyn, the mother, she and her daughter reconcile by accepting the nihilism.
Then I will cherish these few specks of time.
Which is in many ways exactly where Amy Hoop, if I'm saying her name correctly, is left. Am I enjoying how I'm spending my time? It all means nothing in the end. That will, of course, be the last slide. But all we have left is how it makes me feel. And so those who are challenging and daring internet poisoning are sort of there in the tension between, can I keep the feels going enough to keep the nihilism at bay? Because does it all go anywhere, anyway? Now, Grim Grizz declares that he himself is a cautionary tale. Someone who has been deep in the bowels of the religion of Set. Someone who has lost far too much time and energy of his life devoted to chasing pixels across a screen, being initiated into the depths of computer games where it all feels meaningful, but there's no there. And part of the reason that Lungs of Clay, CLAY, was and this section so captured me. Game, and I don't mean game dismissively. You could play exactly the same game.
Do you mean it as he could perform the same dark arts or rhetorical wizardry, perhaps?
That he does with the question of belief in God. Because for Jordan, when I made the video before, I mean, there's a ton of existentialism in here. And Cooper's going to talk about that. Because that's where this goes in the 20th century. It goes into existentialism. Because, okay, if we've sort of thrown out the mythological symbolic language, and we no longer take that seriously, and the history of the physical Jesus doesn't really matter that much. Just his words, just the impact of the kerygma, of the preaching, of the proclamation of.
Now, kerygma is one hell of a word.
When you read Karl Barth, you just have this sense of moments of transformation that come upon you at the, you know, it's very existential.
That line right there, honestly, ladies and gentlemen, is where the text from the thumbnail comes from. What does it take to move a main?
Preaching of the proclamation of the, I mean, when you read Karl Barth, you just have this sense of moments of transformation that come upon you at the, you know, it's very.
And let's think about those for a moment. Like I sit here in this, the pretty, pretty disastrous routine of my life. Right. And I think, What would it take? What sort of external event or shift in context would it take to move me out of the routine I'm in and into a new form of behavior? And things immediately come to mind, like a new life, like my morality attaches its responsibility to, like to maintain the integrity of my character, certain, like, you know, like a cat. When a new cat shows up meowing outside.
Now, he's talking about progress. He does not want to stay stuck where he's at. He, again, describes himself as a cautionary tale. Somehow, forward progress has been made. He is no longer a prisoner of online gaming or computer gaming. I don't know what his particular gaming was, but he's no longer a prisoner of that. And he has come out. We're back to Plato's cave in some ways. He has come out of the cave, yet he knows that he hungers for a place still further to go. And as a culture, we seem to be bankrupt, which I think will continue to send people back to religion. And for my part, send people back to, well, here's the question for the church. Is the church going to be seen and found as a place where there is any hope of this? The church is always a tortured institution, and in that way, it is like Jesus. But the church grows when there is a sense that it has something to offer, and that sense for many people is intuitive. They have a sense of it, at least enough to enter into whatever open door or on-ramp the church has. And for me, this continues to be the heart of my question and the heart of the channel and the heart of my work. Now, 5+ years of making videos, which, like this video, is sort of accumulating bits and pieces gathered from the internet, thinking out loud. But bringing these, of course, into my church, and you'll see them in my sermons, but... And then, of course, into Estuary. Someone recently asked, say more about that Estuary. There's plenty of videos about Estuary, trust me, and there'll be more. But Estuary is church adjacent. And so the prayer continues to be, Lord, send your Holy Spirit. Lord, revive your church. Lord, make your church in an internet age a place where people can drink from the living water and find their source of life, that source of life which will spill over and rejuvenate the culture and give people a sense that God has not abandoned them, but that the kingdom of God is at hand. So leave a comment. Let me know what you think.